We conclude that there is reasonable cause to believe that BPD engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the Constitution and federal anti-discrimination law. BPD engages in a pattern or practice of making unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests, using enforcement strategies that produce severe and unjustified disparities in the rates of stops, searches, and arrests of African Americans, using excessive force, and retaliating against people engaging in constitutionally protected expression. These violations have deeply eroded the mutual trust between BPD and the community it serves.
That's the head of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, Vinita Gupta, speaking about the report issued last week by the Department of Justice in which they describe systemic deficiencies, repeated violations of the Constitution, and bias against African Americans in the Baltimore Police Department. Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to examine this issue in several ways. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk to Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP and now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Last October, he was the lead author of a report called Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. Also, Kevin Rector is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun who has written extensively about the Baltimore police and the courts. He joins me here in the studio. And one of the next steps in the process of police reform is for the city and the Department of Justice to negotiate a consent decree that requires the police to address the multiple problems described in the DOJ report. So how effective have consent decrees been in other jurisdictions? Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post will join us as well. She's covered consent decrees in, among other places, Prince George's County. But first, joining us on the phone is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, who coincidentally was on the Prince George's County Police Force while the consent decrees were in place there. Good morning, Commissioner. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Good morning, Tom, and good morning to Kevin Rector as well. I'm glad you're talking to Lynn Bowie because the consent decree experience in Prince George's really changed our relationship with the community. So I'm glad you're talking to her.
Yeah, we will look forward to that conversation. Indeed, I got to tell you, sir, the thing that struck me about this report was the discrepancy between the report's contention that the problems in the Baltimore Police Department are so pervasive and your continued contention, as well as the contention of Mayor Rawlings Blake and people like Senator Pugh and even Congressman Cummings, you all are contending that the problem really still lies with a small number of bad apples, a small percentage of people on the force who are acting without integrity. To read the report, it's difficult to imagine how a small number of people can commit unconstitutional acts with the pervasiveness that the report describes. Can you explain how that is?
Sure, Tom. And I think it takes a lot of thought and hard work to really look at what the report is saying. Now, the Department of Justice came here because the mayor asked them to come here. Now, that is absolutely unique and something that we shouldn't gloss over. She suspected that this was the case within her police department, and she asked DOJ Civil Rights to come in to help make us better. But when the report describes egregious acts of misconduct, and it does, I assign that to a small number of police officers. Now, when the report also describes enforcement strategies, and the clip that you played with Vinita Gupta describing longstanding enforcement strategies that the BPD has adopted over the last couple of decades, the police officers who have been compelled by political and police leadership to engage in those policing strategies aren't necessarily bad apples. So there's two different conversations. You have police officers who intentionally engage in criminal misconduct. That's one. And then you have police officers that have been the victim of failed policing strategies. They, in and of themselves, are not bad apples. And I think that's worth some conversation. So I still contend and believe with all my heart that the vast majority of Baltimore police officers consistently come to work each and every day and do the right thing. I think it's too easy to look at that contention that I make and represent that I'm somehow wrong now because of this report. I'm not. I realize the difference between the two, and I think Baltimoreans realize the difference between the two.
The mayor has estimated that it could cost the city $5 to $10 million a year to satisfy the requirements that might be negotiated in a consent decree in Los Angeles over a 12-year period. They spent about $300 million. How does $5 or $10 or $20 million a year fix the culture and fix those problems that you've just identified with policing approaches, policing techniques being foisted upon the rank and file, that kind of thing? How does money fix that? What are you going to spend that money on?
Well, money goes toward training and technology, and better trained cops interact in a more constitutional, respectful way with the community. And money also brings much-needed technology to the nation's eighth-largest police department that better prepares police officers to engage in policing strategies that are based on data and not on hunches and suspicions and street corners. So it costs money to run a big-time police department like Baltimore, and forever. The training and technology commitment within this agency has been anemic at best. The inside of a Baltimore police car, and I know Kevin Rector knows this, looks like the inside of my first police car in 1992. There's been no commitment to technology to better prepare police officers to do their job, and there's been little to no commitment to training. We've been a one-dimensional police department for too long. We've engaged in some failed enforcement strategies, and we're at a point now where we know we have to fix it, and this pending consent decree with DOJ will compel and mandate those improvements.
I wonder why it is that the progress in some seemingly easy areas to address appears to be pretty slow. One of the things that the report talks about is seat belting in the vans. This is, of course, something that's been on everybody's minds during the trials that, you know, the first hung jury happened last December. It's been many months. But they're saying that perhaps as many as 20% or more of the people polled by the Department of Justice said that they were unsecured when they were put in the van. Right. 10 months later, how could that be?
Well, Tom and Kevin, let's talk about that for a second, because I recently conducted a surprise inspection at Central Booking, where investigators from Internal Affairs inspected all of the incoming prisoner transport wagons, and the compliance rate was 100%. Now, I read the DOJ report where they report that they polled anonymously criminal defendants at a bail review hearing. And when they polled those criminal defendants at a bail review hearing, they asked them if they were seatbelted in the prisoner transport wagon after they were arrested. And their report indicates that up to 20% of them anonymously responded that they were not seatbelted. Now, I would argue that that is very unscientific. So what I'm going to continue to do is inspect what I expect of my police department, and that inspection will be hands-on, eyes-on with the prisoner transport wagons as they arrive at Central Booking and as they otherwise transport prisoners in the city. It's very, very important to me. We've recently amended our use of force policy that speaks to many, many things, to include prisoner transport. And while I understand that anonymous poll that DOJ took at a bail review hearing, I'm just not too sure that that's too terribly scientific, but I'm going to continue to inspect it within my agency.
All right, Commissioner, I know you have to go this morning, but let me ask you one more question, and that is, what do you think the effect on the street to the rank-and-file police force in Baltimore is going to be now that this report has been made public?
Well, Tom, I met with Vanita Gupta and her staff, with the executive command staff, the day of the DOJ announcement. It was a very robust conversation. Very healthy conversation. I met yesterday with my command staff, the captains and majors and above, and that was a very healthy conversation. Today I'm meeting with my sergeant's advisory board, and to a person, and I mean this without exception, everyone is looking forward to how this relationship with the DOJ and the consent decree can make us a better police department. And I speak quite often throughout the last year with the rank and file here and the commanders about my experience with DOJ and the consent decree in Prince George's County. And it made us better with the community, and it simultaneously made us better at the crime fight. So to the critics out there, and there are some critics who seem to think that a DOJ consent decree will have a negative effect on our capacity to police effectively. I can tell you from my own personal experience that that's just not the case. It'll sharpen our crime fight, and it will certainly make us better in our relationship with the community, and it will compel and mandate those changes. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it, and then we're going to roll up our sleeves and get it done.
All right. Well, Commissioner, I know you're busy this morning. You got to run, but thank you for your time, and we will look forward to having you back soon to continue this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Kevin.
So, Kevin Rector, turning to you, the community was not surprised by this report. I mean, most folks, particularly in communities of color, say this is our lived experience. We've been dealing with this for as long as we can remember. Were you surprised by anything in this report? I mean, you've been covering this for a long time, and you know it as well or better than anybody in town.
It's a good question. I certainly was not surprised by a good number of things in the report. The Baltimore Sun's reporting has borne out some of these things for years. I was a bit surprised by the scope of the findings. And I think, like many people in Baltimore, taken aback a bit by some of the most egregious actions that they laid out.
What about this, the bad apple theory, that it really is, as the commissioner continues to contend, just a small percentage of people? Or is that what you're hearing from folks on the force? Is that what you're hearing from people on the street?
That question is one I put to the commissioner on Wednesday as well. It's a question that I hear from a lot of people on the street. They don't believe that it's just a handful of bad apples. I think the report speaks to the systemic nature of the problems in the police department. And I don't know. I don't know if it's looking at the same thing in two different ways by saying it's bad apples and the rest of the police just don't know how to constitutionally police. And on the other side saying, the whole police department is rotten.
It's somewhere in between. Yeah.
It begs the question. I mean, obviously we're speaking in metaphors here, but what is a bad apple? I mean, if you don't have bad intent or malicious intent necessarily, but you're going around jacking people up on Baltimore streets without cause, then yeah, are you a bad apple or not? I don't know.
Let me welcome Lynn Bowie into the conversation. Lynn is a reporter for The Washington Post. Lynn, good morning. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The next step, now that the city of Baltimore and the Department of Justice have reached an agreement in principle, is to develop a consent decree. What has the experience in Prince George's County? You've written about this as well as consent decrees in other places around the country. How has that worked? Has it been effective? Do people think that, in fact, this was a good way of addressing the problems they identified in PG County?
Yeah, so in the 2000s, the county, had Department of Justice intervention for these excessive canine bites, hundreds of bites in a 7-year period, 800 bites to be more specific, and that prompted a consent decree. But then there was also a separate agreement that included a review of shootings as well. So these two sort of separate agreements forced everyone to not just modernize the department, but then they also looked at general orders and basically rewrote the department's policies through this time span. And after about 5 years of monitoring, the Department of Justice left, and largely everyone says they've come out a very different department. The NAACP over in the county says that their complaints of force went from maybe 10 to 15 calls a month to now one or two. And in speaking with the current police chief, Hank Stawinski, over there, who was part of the team that rewrote policies during Department of Justice review, he said it allowed the department to find efficiencies to not only improve policies, but then those efficiencies allowed them to better focus on the crime fight and, protecting the community, which is what the police department wants to do.
And Kevin Rector, this notion of accountability, I mean, when you talk to the beat cops, when you talk to the folks in the courts, when you talk to people on the street, do you think that the consent decree would be able to enable the department to have officers be more accountable and have data collected that can prove whether or not they're doing what they're saying they're doing?
I think a sentiment I hear a lot is that the Baltimore Police Department is woefully ill-equipped technology-wise. And I think that a lot of people believe that when they start bringing in new technology, putting computers in all the patrol cars, things like that, that there will be a benefit there. But in terms of accountability, I think it's a question that's up in the air. The ACLU of Maryland sued the Baltimore Police Department in 2006, reached an agreement in 2010 that was supposed to address a lot of these unconstitutional stops. We did see arrests come down dramatically in Baltimore, but the data in this new DOJ report is from 2010 to 2015, largely, which is entirely after, or mostly after, the ACLU's agreement with the city went into effect. And what the report shows is that these unconstitutional stops were still happening all over the place. So in terms of whether this consent decree will be different, will hold the police department's feet to the fire, is yet to be seen.
Yeah, and Lynn Bowie, we just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, you talk about the data that suggests things are working, you know, number of complaints down from 15 to 1. But what about the culture? I mean, do people have a palpable sense that the culture of the PG Police Department has changed?
I think, you know, a lot of people in the community think that the trust between the community and the police department has dramatically turned around. I mean, obviously, you know, people will point to continued concerns, but, you know, the NAACP largely has a great relationship with the police department. I think what the work after, you know, something like this that happens over years is you have to keep it up. You know, once the DOJ leaves, once the court ordered
right, got to follow through. Yeah, I got to follow.
Follow through.
Yeah, Lynn Bowie, I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. I appreciate your time and your reporting this morning. Thank you so much, as well as Kevin Rector. Kevin Rector, a writer with the Baltimore Sun, Lynn Bowie with the Washington Post. Coming up after a break for the news, Ben Jealous, former president of the NAACP and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, joins me here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. More on the DOJ report in the Baltimore Police Department after the news. First, it's time for a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
We have revised 26 key policies, including the department's important use of force policy. We're now training all of our officers on these new policies, and we've held additional trainings on key issues that the Justice Department has identified. We are revamping our approach to officer accountability, including the way that the use of force by officers is reviewed and how officers are disciplined. A number of initiatives are underway to improve the police department's transparency and to encourage officers to actively engage with the communities that they serve.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the report issued on Wednesday by the Department of Justice at the request of the mayor and the police department about what the report calls systemic deficiencies and a pattern of unconstitutional behavior by Baltimore police. That was Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake speaking at a press conference on Wednesday. We hope to speak soon with Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP. We're having a little technical difficulty getting in touch with Ben, but in the meantime, Kevin Rector, reporter for the Baltimore Sun, is still with me here in Studio A. Kevin, there are a couple of things about this report that were very surprising to me. One was the fact that Baltimore police sometimes conduct public strip searches. They're taking people's clothes off in the middle of the street in front of their neighbors and in the communities in which they live. That's amazing to me. What did you learn about that practice from this report and from your reporting?
We'd heard of similar situations in the past, and this report confirms that, and you know, puts it in black and white. And it's one of the more egregious things in the report. You can't imagine having that done to you, particularly under the circumstances outlined in the report, which is essentially that they had no reason to even stop the person. It seems like pure harassment and an egregious form of it on the street. One young man had his pants and boxers pulled down in front of his girlfriend on the street. I mean, that is the type of conduct that I think jumps out at people who read this report in Baltimore and say, what's being done? On Wednesday, when the mayor and the commissioner and Vanita Gupta with the Civil Rights Division at the DOJ had a news conference, the commissioner mentioned terminations that he'd made of officers this year. Some people misunderstood that to mean that it was as a result of the DOJ report. Working the beat locally, I knew that wasn't the case. I clarified it with him later that day. He said that, in fact, eight officers have been terminated in the last year under his watch, but none of those terminations have come as a result of the DOJ report. I asked him whether he was looking into the more egregious actions outlined in the report and whether that would result in further investigation and any future terminations of officers. He said that he was looking into the report. He said at the time, this was again Wednesday, that he hadn't read it with a fine-tooth comb, but that he and his top commanders were going to be looking through the report, looking at all of these instances, seeing whether any of the information was new to them or not, and whether they warranted further investigation. Some of the egregious actions outlined in the report have already been investigated by the police department. And again, much of the information that the DOJ found came from the police department. So they had much of this information already.
Would this kind of thing be, would that requirement, as it were, to look into, to further investigate, identify the specific officers who committed these unconstitutional acts, would that be the kind of thing you would expect in a consent decree? Would the DOJ require it? And would a court-appointed monitor make sure it happened?
Not specific to the things outlined in the DOJ report. The DOJ came in specifically to address problems for the department as a whole on the civil side. They did not assess the criminal liability of any of the individual officers involved in any of the incidents outlined in the report. And I don't think it's the case that these sorts of reports have resulted in a large number of terminations elsewhere. What I think that the goal for the DOJ is to lay all the cards on the table, point to the systemic problems, and say, through the consent decree, you have to meet X, Y, and B benchmarks. Here's the threshold. Here are your priorities. And then the court-appointed monitor will come in and essentially be prescriptive. The monitor will say, well, to address this, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And that's really where we will better understand the price tag for this.
Yeah, and the department and the mayor have welcomed the DOJ. They, as you said, they shared information with them. Do you think folks in the department, from your reporting, understand a consent decree, this arrangement by which there is a court monitor appointed to make sure that the Baltimore Police Department does A, B, C, and D to address these problems? Do you think that's the best way? Do people understand this as the best way to have systemic change in the culture of the police department? Lynn Bowie from the Post in the last segment telling us that, you know, there's some evidence that that's happened in PG County. Is there a confidence level that consent decree is the way to go to make these changes happen?
I think there are a lot of different opinions. You know, we've heard from officers who say this is going to take the department in the wrong way. You can't just stop policing in some of these poor black neighborhoods because that's where the homicides are. That's where really bad crime occurs. There are others who say that this is just what we need. I talked to a lieutenant who said, I don't look at it as a bad report card. I look at it as a health checkup, that you're getting told what's wrong, and then you can move forward and get the right medicine and do better. But I also think there are people on the street who are skeptical that this report will translate into sustained improvements in the police department. There are also others, like the Fraternal Order of Police, the union that represents rank and file officers, who say, we've been standing up shouting for some of these reforms for a long time. They put out a statement, I think it was yesterday, saying that the police department should do away with ComStat, which is the...
Which seems to fly in the face of everything the DOJ report said, because, you know, collecting data, which is what ComStat does, is, you know, a linchpin of this.
And yeah. The FOP says that the problem with ComStat is it tracks arrest numbers and essentially creates a motive for officers to make a large number of arrests, which translates into then...
Presents the wrong incentive, yeah.
Right, and then stops for without cause.
All right, well, you've done terrific reporting. I appreciate the reporting and your time this morning. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Kevin Rector is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I'm sorry we were not able to get in touch with Ben Jealous. We had some technical problems reaching him. He is on the road, but we are also grateful to Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post. We've got links to their outstanding reporting on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. For more on the DOJ report, tune in today to Midday with Sheila Cast at noon. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests this morning and every morning provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. So that's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation with Dr. Carla Hayden in her first interview since being confirmed by the Senate as the next Librarian of Congress. Plus, producer Bridget Armstrong reports from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture on their new exhibition, and Dr. Lawrence Jackson on the legacy of Freddie Gray and inequality in Baltimore. All that, plus a theater review with Jayron Russett coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's on the way with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.